Blog Talk Radio.
Chair, I say this to you. I got the random rolls back, man. Remember that? I don't know how long ago it was. Maybe 4 months ago, 5 months ago. Basically, every sentence, mid-sentence, as I'm live on air, I slowly roll away in the chair. The ground is not totally level in here, so every once in a while, it's just, I'm like creeping off to the left as I'm talking to you. Got a great show for you guys today. So we're going to talk a little bit about corruption here, a new poll out from Gallup. That'll be the first story. Then Scott Walker is gone. It actually happened mid-show while we were live yesterday, but I didn't want to do the story mid-show, so I waited until today so I can give you a little bit more information as to the backstory of it. We have Reuters reporting that Jeb Bush is pledging now to be exactly like George W. Bush. That's not literal. He's not, like, actually signing his signature on a piece of paper that says, I will be like George W. Bush. But in essence, he's saying, I will abide by the same policies. That is inarguable. That's clearly what he's doing. So we'll talk about that, and I'll tell you what policies we're talking about. How the U.S. turned a blind eye to child rape in Afghanistan. Stay classy. I got a whole bunch of stuff on Ben Carson and his hatred of all Muslims coming up later on in the show. And Dr. Carl Hart, for those of you who don't know who he is, I think we've done one story on him so far in the history of Secular Talk. We have another story for you guys today. He was on Joe Rogan's show, and man, this guy is a fucking hero. He's one of the few people, may even be the only person that I've come across who, in my opinion, is advocating for all of the right things when it comes to drug policy. You know how nowadays it's very fashionable to stand up for certain kinds of drug use, like, oh yeah, marijuana, we're grandfathering that one in, sweet if you smoke marijuana. Then there are some psychedelics, like, oh, if you do psychedelics, there's nothing wrong with you. A lot of people take it for transformational experiences or whatever. But there are some drugs that we still have that meter in our head where we're like, well, that one, I mean, come on, that one's fucked up. You don't want to advocate that. But we have Dr. Carl Hart, who's coming along and just shattering all of the stereotypes, all the propaganda, all the misinformation when it comes to drug use. So you're not going to want to miss that segment. That's later on in the show. But let's go ahead and get started, and we can kick it off here with the story about corruption. Gallup is out with their annual poll on corruption, and unsurprisingly, the American people are onto the fact that the system is totally broken, and we more or less have a system of legalized bribery set up through campaign contributions. So let's take a look at the chart here, and I'll break it down for you. So as you can see there, in 2007, it was 67% of the American population that thought that corruption was widespread in the government. And as time went by, there's some ebbs and flows here, but we get to today, and you can see 2013, it was 79% that say corruption is widespread. 2014, it's 75%, and this time it's the same. It's 75% now. In fact, I don't know why it doesn't say 2015 there, but I believe it said in the article that it's 75% as well for 2015. Now, believe it or not, this is actually less than some other polls that we've covered on this issue. I've seen polls and I've seen numbers ranging from 80% of the American population being really concerned about corruption to 95% of the American population saying, yeah, corruption is a huge issue. So this is actually a lesser number than all the other numbers that I've seen on this issue. And again, when you get into the specifics, I'm not sure that the American people can tell you exactly what the problem is. But when you speak broadly and when you speak in a generalized way and when you keep it vague, people kind of know they're getting hosed. So this is interesting and it's quite telling yet again. But for everybody who feels defeated on this issue and they think we can't win because the system's too far gone, let me give you a few more numbers here so you can see that it's not like it's this hopeless everywhere in the world. So there's no reason to continue to feel hopeless. In fact, what we should do is we should get up and fight. We should work within the system to change the system fundamentally to make it so that we have a democracy again and not effectively an oligarchy like we have right now. So to give you some more numbers here, how many people feel corruption is a big problem in Norway? Only 30%. Remember, here 75%, there 30%. Okay, how about Finland? 26%. So again, a massive gap between how screwed up we feel our system is and how screwed up they feel their system is. How about Denmark? Only 19% of people in Denmark say corruption is a big problem in their government. And finally, how many people in Sweden? 14%. Wouldn't it be great to live in a country where when you're asked that question by a pollster, your reaction is almost immediately, no, corruption. There's no problem with corruption here. Or if there is a problem with corruption, it's just, you know, every once in a while some sleazy politician gets caught, they're busted, and then they go to jail, and then we move along here. There's a great saying, I forgot who came up with it, but the idea is that here in America, the people are scared of the government. In some places in Europe, it's the opposite. The government is scared of the people. And when I read these numbers, I can't help but think that. Now, again, it's not the same for all areas of Europe. In fact, some places did pretty poorly, and they're right up there with us or close to us. But here are some examples of some places in Europe where that is the case, where the people have said to the government, hey, bitch, your job is to represent me. If you think it's anything different, think again, because I'm going to kick your ass out of power and you're done. So if you want to stay in power, you have to justify to myself and everybody else that's a citizen here why it is you should be in power. Power is not self-justifying. You're the one that needs to provide an argument as to why you think we should be kind enough to let you stay in power. Again, this comes back to one of the fundamental ideas of democracy. Now, of course, when you talk about the U.S. and a lot of these other places too, there's a balance because you have a constitution which lays out rights, which are things that are off the table and non-negotiable. So we don't have tyranny of the majority because you have rights. But outside of the things that are constitutionally protected and are essentially written in stone, well, then, yeah, everything else should be on the table and open to democratic discussion. And we should give a shit what the polls say, and we should implement what the majority of people want. And what we're looking at in America, as we've gone through here, is that the overwhelming majority of Democrats, independents, Republicans, and everybody, the system's broken, the system's not working, corruption is the main problem. Wouldn't it be great if we lived in a country where only 14% of us said, yeah, corruption's a problem? Because you know what that would mean? The government is much more representative. Now, again, I don't think people can give you the specifics because they don't follow this stuff for a living. But when you get into the specifics, the dynamic of the problem is actually very straightforward. You have lobbyists, you have corporations, you have individual big money rich donors who give money to the politicians, and then the politicians more or less do their bidding, and in most cases, they only do the bidding of their donors. And then this is how you keep the system going, and this is how you have a kleptocracy or an oligarchy, is that when you look at the overwhelming majority of the American people, when you look at the middle class and the poor, we almost never get what we want when you look at the opinion polls. But who gets exactly what they want? The rich. When you poll the rich and ask what they want, that's what we actually end up getting in terms of the real policy that's implemented. So we need to fight back. We need to defeat this. We've spoken about it before, but we'll talk about it again here. There's multiple different movements working on this. For example, Tom Hartman is working on one specific way to tackle this problem. Move to Amend is the name of their group. you can certainly support them. There's others as well. I think there's represent.us, represent.us. There's like crowdfunding campaigns where the people raise money together and then the people determine which candidates to give money to. That's another way to tackle the problem. And then, of course, there's different state initiatives, and there's a variety of different ways. I support all the different ways, but I do believe, not just because I'm part of the network here, TYT, who's one, you know, they're some of the people who birthed this idea, but I do believe that Wolfpack is probably the best way to attack the problem, because Wolfpack goes to the heart of the issue. The heart of the issue is you need a constitutional amendment. If you just have a law, and a lot of people want just a law to fight back against this, understand, guys, they can be changed very quickly from one administration to the next administration or one Congress to the next Congress. Or even if they don't change it, laws can be ignored. There are plenty of financial regulations, economic regulations on the books that are totally ignored today. Some anti-monopoly laws are totally ignored. So I don't think a law is strong enough in order to beat this. Don't get me wrong, I'd support a law if it came up and they said, hey, this is to regulate money in politics and, you know, let's try to do it. Well, okay, great, I support it. By the way, I think the Supreme Court would slap it down. But either way, I'd support it. But the real heart of the problem is you need a constitutional amendment to fight back against this, because the Constitution, while of course there are examples of it being out and out ignored, it is harder to ignore a constitutional amendment. And especially if you just set the amendment today and we win the battle today. I mean, at one time we had prohibition, and everybody said, we'll never get rid of prohibition. This is with us here forever. And then what happened? They fucking got rid of prohibition. I mean, let me ask you, if you think, if it's 1959 and you're living in segregated Mississippi and you're a black family, and somebody says to you, hey, within 5 years, the official system of segregation will be gone, would you believe them? You'd say, fuck no. What are you, crazy? I think this is going to continue because there are no signs that it's going to go away. So what? Some people are mad about it and they're protesting. It doesn't mean anything. It's not going to change anything. This is our reality. We're used to our reality. And a lot of people felt defeated. And you know what? They were wrong to feel defeated. Because you keep fighting, you keep fighting, you keep fighting, and then eventually you win. And before you win, everybody says there's no way you're going to win. But then after you win, everybody goes, oh, it was inevitable. They were going to win no matter what. So you see how this works? So the bottom line is we need to fight on all fronts to fix the heart of the problem, because this is the main issue that affects all other issues in politics. 80% of the American people want to raise the minimum wage. Are we going to get a good minimum wage increase and chain it to inflation and do all the right things without getting money out of politics? It's a very tiny percentage chance. Again, over 80% of the American people say we want a minimum wage increase. We haven't gotten it yet. Why? Because they don't give a shit what you think. How about universal background checks for gun purchases? Over 90% of the American people want to do that. Even a majority of Republicans are on that side. We don't get it. Again, because of money in politics and the influence of the NRA and the gun manufacturers and lobbyists. And I could go issue for issue here. Only 17% of the American people want to be involved in Syria. Guess what? We're involved in Syria. We're bombing right now. Why? Because they don't care what you think. Well, we can force our government to care about what we think, because we would be the ones paying them, so they would only listen to us. As of right now, they take money from private donors, so they're going to listen to the private donors. And that's why you see the system as screwed up as it is right now, and it's time to fight back. Okay. Next, Scott Walker. Actually, let me take a sip of water here. You don't even realize when you're mid-rant how thirsty you are. And I brush my teeth before I come on air sometimes. And that makes you parched. I don't really understand why, but it does. All right. Do I have a clip for this? No, I do not. Because who wants to hear Scott Walker talk? If you do listen to him talk, you're probably going to fall asleep. Scott Walker has officially dropped out of the Republican primary race. He was polling horribly. The way that some of the national polls work, they have to either round up or round down. Word is that Scott Walker got less than 0.5% in the last poll, which means they have to round down, and he registered at 0.0%, which is terribly embarrassing, especially because he was leading in many polls just a few months ago. Kind of like Rick Perry the last time that he ran, when he ran in 2012, how everybody was like, oh my God, he's got a great economic record. When you dive into the details, it wasn't great. but they think, oh, he's got a good economic record, he's relatively unknown, but he looks like a leader. And Rick Perry was polling as he's going to destroy the field before the primary race in 2012. Well, the same thing happened to Scott Walker here. Before Trump got in, he got in. Everybody's like, oh, yes, the conservative hero, the fallback. This guy looks presidential, yada, yada. And then what ended up happening, we all know what happened. He went from leading to, the second he opened his mouth, Tanksville, straight down. Now, again, I'm a little surprised by this, to be honest with you, because I had him as one of the establishment fallback candidates, if you will. So, in other words, I thought he was going to fly under the radar, or he would be one of the people that fly under the radar, and then eventually, when people actually go in the voting booth, they go, I'm not really going to vote for Trump, because Trump's got a fucking raccoon on his head. So who am I going to vote for? I guess it's either Marco Rubio, Jeb Bush, or Scott Walker. But he didn't hang around that long, and to be fair, it really didn't look like he was going to hang in there nearly as much as the other guys are going to hang in there. So perhaps it was a good move to save some face, even though it's already embarrassing. But Liz Mayer, who worked for his campaign briefly, who's a Republican consultant, laid out some reasons why he failed so spectacularly. So I want to give you just some of the things that she said here. She says, things he got wrong: misunderstanding the GOP base, its priorities and stances, pandering, flip-flopping, becoming so invested in winning, no matter what it took, that he lost sight of his real identity as a political leader. And she says, not educating himself fast enough on issues outside of governor's remit, educating himself on some things by talking to the wrong people. All right, so now let me give you the real reason, or I should say real reasons, the simplified reasons here. Number one, he didn't do well because he's a dunce. Now, that's not the end-all be-all in the Republican race, because virtually all of them are dunces. So take it for what it's worth. That's not the biggest reason here. But one reason is he's on another level of dunciness. So just to give one example, he repeatedly compared unions in his state to ISIS. Somebody asked him, hey, what are you going to do to beat ISIS when you're president? He's like, well, you know, I have a lot of experience fighting back against the unions in my state, so I'll know what to do. People were like, what the fuck? Then he doubled down on that. Wait for it. Then he tripled down on that. That's on a whole other level of stupid. That's deeply, deeply stupid. So that's one of the reasons why he's not doing well. He's not all that bright. But the other reason is he's the establishment candidate that forgot he had to appeal to real people. You see, there's an issue with this here. Scott Walker is so used to the corrupt version of politics that we have in America right now that he forgot that it's not just about raising money behind the scenes and sucking off the Koch brothers who backed him, by the way, or sucking off Sheldon Adelson or Foster Freeze or any big money donors or any other lobbyists. He forgot that that's not all there is to the job. He forgot that the way a good politician in this broken system functions is you raise money from those guys, and then you're also able to turn around and say to the American people, no, I'm with you. I'm with the working class. I'm with the regular guy. Here's why I'm with the regular guy. And oh my God, these other guys are sellouts, but me, I'm not a sellout, even though you are taking money from the big money people. He forgot that that's a thing. And virtually all the other Republicans, save maybe Trump and maybe a little bit Paul, they know that's a thing. And they're functioning within that system, and they get the breakdown. They get that you can't talk to Bob in Tuscaloosa like he's one of your billionaire donors. He doesn't get that, man. You know who else doesn't get this? Just as a throwaway point here, but Chris Christie. Chris Christie, one of the things he's saying in all the debates is, we have to cut Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. We have to do it. We have to be responsible. We're lying to the American people when we say that we can keep these programs the same. Now, number one, he's wrong about that. But number two, nobody wants to fucking hear that. Even the Republican base, when you look at the polling on this, they want to keep Social Security and Medicare. They don't want cuts for those programs under any circumstance. Even when you frame it as to balance the budget, they go, no, keep those. So this is another guy who's like, all right, everybody out there is just like my donors that I talk to behind closed doors, so this is going to be easy. I just have to make the same pitch I would make to my donors when I'm in front of the TV cameras. But that's a horrible idea. You're not going to win that way. So, I mean, to some extent, Mitt Romney had this problem as well. To some extent, the overwhelming majority of Republicans have this issue today as well. They're so corrupt, they're so backwards, that they don't get that this isn't normal. They don't get that people don't want our politics to be run by rich assholes, whether they're liberal or conservative. Nobody wants Wall Street running the show. And Scott Walker wholly bought into the bullshit dichotomy that we have in American politics. He was all in on the corrupt system. He didn't think there was anything wrong with it, and that's one of the main reasons why he tanked and one of the main reasons why he's out. So now I'm going to tell you who the new establishment fallback candidates are. Like I said, Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio, but now to replace Scott Walker, it's probably Carly Fiorina. She's made some noise in the first two debates. And perhaps they think, well, she certainly is for sale, but perhaps the big money people think, well, we can control her and she's got a better shot, so let's go with her. Maybe to a lesser degree, Kasich, but I still think Kasich is too moderate for a lot of the big money Republican donors. So we'll have to wait and see. But I do think now that while you have Trump running away, according to the polls, the establishment fallback candidates are still Jeb, Marco Rubio, and now to a lesser degree, Fiorina to replace the pathetic Scott Walker. Okay. All right, now we'll do one more here and then we'll take a break. It is Jeb Bush. Reuters is reporting that Jeb Bush took a pledge to place a freeze on all new federal government regulations if he becomes president. All new federal government regulations. They say the following, quote, "For Bush, regulatory reform is a key part of a broad economic agenda that he says would be aimed at generating annual U.S. economic growth of 4%. Complaining that the cost of complying with regulations is costing U.S. businesses billions of dollars, he would require that any new regulatory costs be offset by rollbacks in regulations elsewhere. Bush will cite in particular the cost of complying with the Dodd-Frank Wall Street reform legislation enacted after the near collapse of the financial system in 2008 and 2009. So let's stop and think about this here. What he's doing is he's pledging to take away the only systemic fix put in place after his brother crashed the economy. Now, it's a little more complicated than that because, of course, Bill Clinton also played a role in helping to crash the economy. He's the one that signed the repeal of Glass-Steagall, for example. He did some deregulation in his own right. And actually, it's virtually every president from Reagan and on that kind of chipped away at efficient regulation of the marketplace and chipped away at the social safety net, among other things. So they all share some blame in this. But with Dodd-Frank, what we have is a little itty-bitty fix. It's like a Band-Aid with some ointment on it over a gaping gangrenous wound. Is it going to fix the problem? No. But is it a step in the right direction? Better than having it, no ointment on it, no Band-Aid? Yes, it is better than that. Jeb Bush is coming along and saying, get rid of the Band-Aid, let's get rid of the ointment, and let's jam this sucker in reverse and go the same direction that my brother went when he crashed the economy. What bugs me to no end about this is Republicans apparently never learn, and the media never calls them out on the fact that they never learn. Guys, it's not just a matter of opinion that trickle-down economics doesn't work. We have the history and the economic data to prove that it doesn't work. So, for example, in the late 19-teens and early 1920s, guess what we implemented? This right-wing economic idea of cut taxes for the rich, deregulate. And what ended up happening? We had the stock market crash and the Great Depression in 1929. Now, after that, we had Roosevelt. We implemented some liberal economic reforms, or I should say progressive economic reforms. And we were able to have a relatively stable system for a while there. But then you had Ronald Reagan come in the 1980s, and he did the same thing they did in the 19-teens and the 1920s, where you cut taxes for the rich and you deregulate, And what happened? The same thing. You had boom-bust cycles. Reagan left his predecessors with a mess. So what happens is, typically when you cut taxes for the rich and you deregulate, you have a tremendous takeoff in wealth where it looks like, oh my God, the good times are never going to end, just like the Roaring Twenties. That's why they called it the Roaring Twenties. Oh my God, economic wealth for everybody. But it wasn't real wealth. It was fake. The credit was too loose. There was no efficient regulation of the marketplace. So you had the economy and the stock market take off, and then there was a fucking crash. Every single time throughout history you implement right-wing economics, the same thing happens. It's not steady, consistent, intelligent growth. You have essentially the smartest people in the room, the Wall Street CEOs, make horrible decisions to enrich themselves, and they screw over everybody else in the process, among other problems. So Reagan left us with a mess because of this economic ideology, and then you had George W. Bush, and again Clinton to a lesser degree, but they also screwed up the economy by doing the same thing. In Bush's case, cut taxes for the rich, do more regulation, and voila, in 2008, what happened? We had the subprime mortgage crisis and the Great Recession. Obama and the Democrats do a little itty-bitty step in the right direction. There's a trillion loopholes in Dodd-Frank, but it's a little step in the right direction. And now Jeb Bush is saying, vote for me to bring back the shitty economic policies which created the problem in the first place. No thank you, Jeb. You're a joke. Step aside. We're done with Bushes. All right. Take a break. When we come back, New York Times has an incredible article detailing how the U.S. turned a blind eye to child rape in Afghanistan. Then we'll get into Glenn Beck, Sean Hannity, and a whole bunch of anti-Muslim garbage coming out of conservatives on Fox News. Stay right there, guys.
Suicide, I cry when angels deserve to die.
Got a very depressing story to share with you. As you're about to see, the New York Times has an incredible article out detailing how the U.S. turned a blind eye to child rape by our allies in Afghanistan. So let me give you some of the quotes from the piece. They say the following. In his last phone call home, Lance Corporal Gregory Buckley Jr. told his father what was troubling him. From his bunk in southern Afghanistan, he could hear Afghan police officers sexually abusing boys they had brought to the base. Quote, at night we can hear them screaming, but we're not allowed to do anything about it. The Marine's father, Gregory Buckley Sr., recalled his son telling him before he was shot to death at the base in 2012. He urged his son to tell his superiors. Quote, my son said that his officers told him to look the other way because it's their culture. Wow, they continue. Rampant sexual abuse of children has long been a problem in Afghanistan, particularly among commanders who dominate much of the rural landscape and can bully the population. The practice is called bacha bazi, which literally means boy play, and American soldiers and Marines have been instructed not to intervene. In some cases, not even when their Afghan allies have abused boys on military bases, according to interviews and court records. The policy has endured as American forces have recruited and organized Afghan militia to help hold territory against the Taliban, but soldiers and Marines have been increasingly troubled that instead of weeding out pedophiles, the American military was arming them in some cases and placing them as the commanders of villages and doing little when they began abusing children. Quote, the reason we were here is because we heard the terrible things the Taliban were doing to people, how they were taking away human rights, said Dan Quinn, a former Special Forces captain who beat up an American-backed militia commander for keeping a boy chained to his bed as a sex slave. But we were putting people into power who would do things that were worse than the Taliban. Isn't this incredible? And finally, they say, the policy of instructing soldiers to ignore child sexual abuse by their Afghan allies is coming under new scrutiny, particularly as it emerges that service members like Captain Quinn have faced discipline, even career ruin, for disobeying it. After the beating, the Army relieved Captain Quinn of his command and pulled him from Afghanistan. He has since left the military. Guys, this is unbelievable. So we have a situation where if you're an American soldier and you stand up to fight back against a child rapist, you get in trouble. Because they say, no, there's a greater good being served here. These guys are on our side. They're against the Taliban. So since they're helping us beat back the Taliban, they get to do whatever they want. Well, isn't this just a perfect example of tribalism? And isn't this just a perfect example of the perverse idea that, well, we and our allies are the good guys by definition, so it doesn't matter what we do that's wrong. It's not wrong by definition. So we get to do whatever we want. You can't criticize it. And then the other guys are the bad guys by definition. So no matter what they do, even when they may or may not do things that are neutral or even good, you can't give credit, you can't say that's okay, because they're not on our team, and these guys are on our team, even though they're pedophiles, so they can get away with it. No, that's not how a rational person thinks, and this shows you how gross our foreign policy is. I mean, it also shows you how gross Afghani culture is. But it definitely shows you that we care more about geopolitical power and strength. We care more about continuing to have a stranglehold on certain regions than we do about morality. If we really gave a shit about Sharia law, fighting Sharia law and preserving human rights, we wouldn't, for example, be allies with Saudi Arabia, who are the worst example of a Wahhabi government. We wouldn't, for example, have let Brunei into our Trans-Pacific Partnership deal, which we're still trying to get, because they just implemented Sharia law last year. And then after they announced that they're officially implementing Sharia, the U.S. government goes, great, you want to get in on our trade deal here? And Malaysia, for example, there was a big report that came out recently which found that they openly tolerate slave labor. And the U.S. is like, great, you want to get in our economic deal? So wait, let me get this right. The U.S. is going to say we care about freedom and democracy and human rights, but then we're buddy-buddy with certain governments that do Sharia and certain governments that do slavery, and some people who are pedophiles openly, they're child rapists openly, but it's okay, they're on our side, they're the good guys by definition. No, that's not true. That's not the case. I mean, I feel like I'm explaining morality 101 right now. Like, okay, guys, what are we against? We're against child rapists. We're against pedophiles. We're against slavery. We're against religious theocratic law. We're against Sharia. We're against the idea that women aren't 100% equal. Need I go down the fucking list? But what's so amazing is that the idiots in Washington totally lost sight of all this. Because, again, it's more about power and control and natural resources and imperialism than it is anything else. Just like that story we covered recently about how General Petraeus said, in order to topple Assad, what we need to do is arm, I'm not joking, moderate Al-Qaeda members. He floated that idea. Even other people in the room were even like, well, geez. Well, I mean, come on. We're one thing for the child rapists, am I right? We can let that slide, but moderate Al-Qaeda, I mean, I don't know. I'm not sure they'll be with us. These guys never fucking learn. They never learn. Even the fact that you considered that idea shows me you're a dumbass. No, I want to be kind about it, and I want to sugarcoat it, or I wish the truth were not that, but that is the truth. If you consider arming Al-Qaeda because you dislike Assad so much because Assad is aligned with Iran and Russia, well, then you have mental issues. No, you are not accurately diagnosing the moral problems around the world. In fact, I don't even think you give a shit one way or the other about morality, because I come back to my main point, it's not really about morality. What this tells me is, number one, it's something we already knew, that some cultures are objectively inferior. If your culture tolerates, the good guys in your culture are like, yeah, we rape little boys, well, then your culture sucks. What do you want me to say? So I take away that from this, and I take away the fact that, unfortunately, there's a certain level and a certain degree of moral relativism among our imperialist shitty government, because they don't give a shit. That's not really why they're doing it. They don't care about freedom. They don't care about democracy. They don't care about being anti-Sharia. They don't care about rights. They don't care about civil liberties. They give a shit about none of those things. It's really about more power and more control, to the point that we were willing to align ourselves with child rapists and let them rape people on our bases because it's okay, they're on our side, so they get to do whatever the fuck they want. No, you might want to look in the mirror, because it certainly is not as simple as they bad guy, we good guy. Because you cannot be the good guy when you're allowing stuff like this and giving it your stamp of approval. You also are a bad guy. Okay. God, that's so sad. That's your tax dollars, dude. Oh, that's your tax dollars. That's my tax dollars. If you're listening to this and you're in America, what are we going to do, man? What are we going to do? That guy's a hero, too, by the way. The one guy who was like, no, I'm not going to let you fucking rape a child in front of me. They dismissed him out of the army because of it. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. All right. Now we'll move along to Glenn Beck here. There it is. Okay, got my clip. Glenn Beck spoke a little bit about the recent anti-Muslim controversy brewing in the GOP. So he's going to start out here kind of making a little bit of sense. I'll break it down when we come back as to the specific areas where he makes a little bit of sense. I stress a little bit. But then by the end, naturally, since it's Glenn Beck, he drives the car into a ditch. Let's watch.
If you think the problem is Muslims, then you need to read the book It Is About Islam. It's not a book of it's not an apologist book by any stretch of the imagination. It shows you the difference between a Muslim and an Islamist. Islamists are the ones that believe in Sharia law. If you come over here, I know lots of Muslims. I know a very good friend of ours is Dr. Zudi Jasser, and he is the quintessential Muslim, but he's a reformer. They want to kill him because he believes that we don't have to be Islamists. Much of the world believes they have to be Islamists. There's the big difference. So it's not a Muslim, it's an Islamist. You know, we got a big problem in this country. It's called Islamists. Because those are the ones that kill.
And then you don't have a problem.
They don't have a problem.
Said, but yes,
no, don't have a problem. It's not what he said. Okay, so now, next.
Current president is one.
Stop. Right. We know our current president is one. Thank you, Peter.
No, we don't know that. No,
in fact, we know the opposite.
Yeah. There's no way this guy's getting down and praying seven times a day. Five or seven.
Five, whatever it is. There's no way this guy's getting down and praying once.
No.
I don't believe this guy believes in God the way we understand God. And that's Muslim, Christian, Jewish. I just don't think he sees
right.
it.
And by the way, his biggest donor of the 2012 campaign also agrees with you, Bill Maher, who does not think
right.
he believes in God at all.
Right. At all.
So, you know, I mean, I don't, you know, is that true? I don't know.
I don't know. I don't judge him. I don't judge him on his religious. I can't judge him. Is he a Muslim? No. Does he view things through the lens of an Islamist? I think so.
Oh. He was trying, man. He was like the little engine that could. He's like, all right, I made half a point that made sense. All right, I just defended Obama and said he's not a Muslim. And then by the end, his bowels just open up and he shits the bed. He's like, he's not a Muslim, but he views the world through the lens of an Islamist. Are you talking about? All right, so let me break this down from the top. So at the beginning, credit to Beck here where he says, look, the problem, because the guy at the Trump rally said, we got a problem in this country, it's called Muslims. And Beck, to his credit, goes, no. The problem isn't Muslims. The problem was never Muslims. He says the problem is Islamists, and there's a difference. Islamists believe in political Islam. That's a problem. They want to implement Sharia. Now, the difference between Islamists and jihadists is that jihadists want to implement Sharia by force. That's like the worst of the worst. Islamists say, hey, let's use the system against itself. Let's use democracy against itself to then implement Sharia via peaceful means. But then, of course, the end result, Sharia is, by definition, I would argue, not peaceful. So that's a problem. So he's right when he says the problem is Islamists and jihadists. The problem is not Muslims. So good for him. He's more reasonable than the idiots at the Trump rally. Congratulations. But then he also goes on to make a little bit more sense when he says, well, the guy who says Obama's a Muslim, that's just not true. And even his co-hosts are usually yes men. Well, I guess in this case they were yes men too. But they're like, yeah, come on, that's not true. He says he's a Christian, take him at his word, yada, yada. I like how they throw out that maybe he's an atheist, but he's not a Muslim. But then, of course, he had to say, Obama views the world through the lens of an Islamist. You know, I'm getting so sick and tired. People are throwing around this term so lightly now. Islamist, you're an Islamist apologist. You view the world through the lens of an Islamist. To people who certainly do not. So a good example is this here. President Obama, you go down the list of everything he believes. Now, obviously, he's not as liberal, not as progressive as I would like him to be. But, you know, he's a guy who's in favor of gay marriage. He's a guy who's, you know, open-minded, tolerant on social issues. That is most certainly not the lens of an Islamist. Foreign policy, yes, he's not as aggressive as the neocons who want to invade everybody and their mother, but, you know, he does drone strikes, which I think still go too far because he kills too many civilians, airstrikes in Syria, yada, yada. His idea, again, whether or not I agree with it is a separate issue. His idea is be more precise in how we go about our interventions and whatnot. Is that the same thing an Islamist would believe? Are they measured in their approach, or do they try to be measured in their approach to foreign policy? No, this is what's funny is he defends him, and then he immediately goes on to make a claim that wipes out his entire defense of him. He's like, he's not a Muslim, but it's worse. He views the world through an Islamist lens. No, he doesn't. We got to stop with this Islamist nonsense. I mean, even the idea, we've seen it recently, from guys I respect and guys I've defended time and time again on many different issues. You know, whether it's Sam Harris or whether it's Richard Dawkins, although I don't think Dawkins does this nearly as much, or it's other so-called new atheists, they're very quick to dismiss any people who are critics of them if they're coming from a progressive angle as, well, you're just Islamist apologists. Do you know what you're saying? What you're saying, that doesn't make any sense. You're saying, well, you know, they're apologizing for people who would want to implement political Islam. No, perhaps when they talk about the reasons which would lead somebody to become an Islamist, what they're doing is they are explaining how somebody could have been radicalized and gotten to that conclusion. That's not to apologize for them, and that's certainly not to say they're secretly on their side or they would be okay if they won. Of course they disagree with that, whether it's Glenn Greenwald you're talking about or Cenk or anybody else. This idea that, well, you know, that's how they are, where these guys are, they're Islamist apologists. Then why is it that every other fucking video or every other thing that Glenn Greenwald writes is in favor of gay rights or is against any kind of militaristic policy or is for open-minded, tolerant things on social issues? It's just, I want people to be accurate and fair about their terminology. And we shouldn't be, you know, using broad attacks that aren't true. And here we have a case where Glenn Beck is saying to President Obama, hey, you're not a Muslim, but you view the world through an Islamist lens. Absolute nonsense. All right. One more, then we'll take a break. We'll go to Sean Hannity. Sean Hannity weighed in on the Syrian refugee crisis. I'm sure you already see where this is going. Let's listen.
We've got entire states now that are being taken over by ISIS and Al-Qaeda. You know, here America probably would like to, on any other, at any other time, take in refugees from Syria and Iraq. You know why I say we can't take in these refugees? Because our National Intelligence Director, James Clapper, our State Department, have both told us that ISIS and Al-Qaeda will infiltrate the refugee community so that they can get to Western Europe and the United States to commit acts of terror. So where we otherwise would probably help people out, we're not in a position to do so now, Mike. Whose fault is that? Why should America, if we're told by our intelligence professionals that ISIS and Al-Qaeda will infiltrate the refugee population to sneak in here, why should we take in one person? I argue we should not.
He doesn't even want to take one Syrian refugee. Now, for those of you who don't know the details on this, we discussed it yesterday. John Kerry announced that by, I believe, the year is 2017, we're going to take in a total of 100,000 refugees. Not all of them from Syria, but many of them from Syria. So I believe the numbers are 70,000 this year, or maybe it was 70,000 last year, then 85,000, and then we go up to 100,000. So it's a slight increase in how many refugees we're taking. And just to give you some perspective here, I think Germany said they're going to take 1 million Syrian refugees. So it's not like he's kind of framing it like, oh, these crazy liberals are in control, and they're saying, let's take all of Syria. No, that's the implication of the taste you get when you listen to what he's saying here. That's not the case. I think what the number Kerry came up with, in my opinion, is actually fair, relatively speaking. And let's get into the specifics, because his claim is, well, you can't take any Syrian refugees because some of them might be bad people. Well, then, Hannity, you are guilty of, when people accuse you of this, you now cannot hide from it. You are guilty of saying, well, I don't care about the majority of them that may be innocent and trying to escape a war zone. I don't care about them because some may be radicals, some may be extremists. So then don't say you're not saying, you know, the majority of Muslims are radical when people charge you of that. Because you're admitting, I don't want to take anybody because some of them may be radical. Well, that's a fucked up position. So understand, guys, we actually have a pretty complex vetting system set up right now. Hannity makes it seem like no matter what, if we accept people, we're never going to know if they're extremists. That's not true. We actually have a complex vetting system set up. There was a case where two Iraqi refugees were suspected of having ties to Al-Qaeda, and guess what? There was a thorough background check on them. We found evidence that they planted roadside bombs in Iraq. We found evidence they were indeed connected to Al-Qaeda. So what happened? We tried them, and they're in jail. See, this is how you approach this. Now, you can debate as to whether or not you want to put them in jail or whether or not you just want to deport them and get them out of here or whatever the case is, but we have a system in place. The system does make sure we get rid of potential terrorists or radicals or extremists, which means that we understand to a certain degree we can be relatively sure, hey, these people are moderate, these people are not, and we're going to allow these ones in, and we're going to kick out these ones. But Sean Hannity is saying, forget all the nuance. I don't want to take even a single Syrian refugee because you know how they are. They might be bad people, so forget it. Well, you just don't know the values of this country then, Sean. Because if you read what it says on the Statue of Liberty, for example, we are clearly a country that's open to immigration, and we think that's what makes America great, having all kinds of different people. And just from a pure humanitarian perspective here, what kind of a human being would tell to a family that you're almost certain is a moderate family just trying to escape a war zone and not die, you need to turn around and go back? Because some other people who might look like you or be part of the same religion are bad people. I'm going to blame you for them, so get the fuck out of here. No, that makes you a bad person. That does mean, Sean, that you generalize. And imagine, just flip the script here for a second. Could you imagine people fleeing from America because, God forbid, some horrible natural disaster, some war breaks out that's insane and half the country's got to flee, and then you try to get into other countries and they say to you, have you seen the list of atrocities that your country was involved in? I don't think you've seen this. Do you know how many countries you've invaded post-World War II? Do you know how many democratic governments your country has toppled in South America and put in authoritarian leaders? Are you aware of how many drone strikes Obama has done and how many civilians have been killed as a result of it? Are you aware of the number of innocent Muslims that have died in just the past decade in offensive wars waged by the United States of America? How am I supposed to know that you weren't part of the military? I guess I can't let you in because some people who are American have done bad things, and therefore I'm going to let that define you, even if you were not involved in those things. Get the fuck out of here. See, if you flip the generalization, if you flip the stereotype, well, then everybody goes, whoa, look at this on a case-by-case basis. Be smart about this. When you're talking about the other in the mind of an idiot like Sean Hannity, he's fine with the generalizations. He's comfortable with it because, you know how they are, so fuck it. I don't even want to take a single Syrian refugee. Understand, guys, there's some people who want to get rid of the vetting system to just allow people in much faster and stop the slow bureaucracy. I'm actually against those people. I think we do need to have a vetting system for anybody from anywhere coming from around the world. So I'm not in the most progressive liberal camp here where I say, let everybody in and no checks. But I am in the camp of let people in. You just got to vet them and make sure everything's okay. But after you do that, yes, allow in at least 100,000 Syrian refugees, because I'm sure the overwhelming majority are people who are just trying to escape a war-torn area. The long-term solution, we hope, is Syria and the Middle East writ large, you know, becomes a better place, and there's not so much war and there's not so much strife. That's the long-term solution, we hope. But in the short term, you got to be rational, you got to be humanitarian. Yes, you vet people, but you do allow in refugees because it's the right thing to do. Okay, let's take a break here. When we come back, on the Fox News show, The Five, they're going to debate the Iran deal, and they make a trillion ignorant claims. And then also we got Ben Carson, we got Dr. Carl Hart, just so much great stuff in the last 30 minutes. Stay right there, guys. We'll be right back. Blog Talk Radio, Secular Talk Radio, Kyle Klinsky Show. Everybody, get started here. The last segment. All right, I got a bunch of Fox coming up here. Then later we'll get to Dr. Carl Hart and his great appearance on Joe Rogan's show. All right, first Eric Bolling. I think I got a couple Eric Bolling here, which is quite depressing, but nonetheless. On the Fox News show, The Five, they're going to debate the Iran deal, and they make about 8,000 hilariously ignorant claims.
The Persians I know all want to make money and live in Southern California, and I think
don't
that the people...
They
don't behead in Iran. ...of the Prophet Muhammad. Are you kidding me? They can yell death to America, and we're supposed to say, oh, you don't really understand the interpretation, or we don't really...
Don't you want to work things out, and you'll
be beheaded? What has the United States done? Remember the Vincennes shooting down the Iranian passenger liner? There's plenty of reasons that the Iranians have to have a beef against us.
Wow.
Now, that's the truth.
Come on.
They have
committed countless acts, apparently, including holding 52 American diplomats for 440 days.
Do you want a permanent state of war?
I want a permanent state of awareness and common sense. Know who your enemy is.
Shot
down the airliner on purpose.
Eric, why do you say something stupid like that?
No, because I'm not like stupid.
No, you said that
to make me look stupid, and I don't like it.
When you talk
terrorists, and you talk about why we
come on, that's an anti-intellectual.
Did you not just bring up the
shooting that was? You can't bring that. We shot down an Iranian airliner.
Well, then why bring it up?
Then
why would you? Why would you say?
Well, because why do you think they're pissed off?
It was an accident, right?
Of course, it was an accident.
It was an accident when Iranian money was probably funneled into 19 Saudi terrorists that flew airplanes into the World Trade Center. Was that an accident?
Okay.
Eric Bolling doesn't know the difference between Sunni and Shia. He just said the Iranian government was probably involved in funding 9/11. Eric, it is laughable how little you know about the Middle East. You know nothing. You know who's fighting those people, Eric? You know who's fighting the ideology that was responsible for the funding of 9/11? That would be the Iranians. Iran is Shia. ISIS and Al-Qaeda are Sunni. The officials in the Saudi government, who are also Sunnis, fundamentalist Sunnis, Wahhabists, or Salafists, however you want to, it's the same thing. They're the ones who funded 15 of the 19 hijackers on 9/11 were Saudi. You have to know this. To be on TV and to talk about politics and foreign policy, and you don't know that? No, you just simply put, you shouldn't be on TV. And it's not because, hey, I'm PC and I'm offended by what you're saying. No, very simply, you are spreading misinformation. What you're saying is factually incorrect. You're not doing your job right. This is the equivalent of if you work for a burger place, somebody orders a burger and you give them a chicken sandwich, and then they come back and say, no, I ordered a burger, and then you fucking give them a chicken sandwich again. Well, then I got to let you go, because apparently every time somebody says burger, you think fucking chicken sandwich. That's not true. That's not what they ordered. That's not what it is. Same thing, all you are, the Iran probably funded. What the fuck are you talking? They didn't fund it. They had nothing to do with 9/11. And then also at the beginning, I don't know if you caught it, he blamed Charlie Hebdo on the Iranians and the Shiites. You know nothing about Islam. You know nothing about fundamentalism. You know nothing about the Middle East. Again, the people responsible, all these individual, or I should say the overwhelming majority of the fundamentalists and the extremist groups that Eric Bolling knows, Al-Qaeda, ISIS, the Taliban, they're one version or another of Sunni fundamentalism. These are not the Shias. Iran is Shia. He just doesn't know, man. He doesn't know. And he also managed to throw out the misinformation Iran's beheading people. They're not beheading people. That's our oil butt buddy, Saudi Arabia. By the way, are you going to do a long rant blaming them, saying they're the problem, saying, you know, if anything, we should invade them and topple them? Because I know how militaristic you are. When it's Iran, oh, my God, you can't wait to get involved in a scuffle. Iran, since it's our buddy, Saudi Arabia, are you going to talk about that? I'll wait for it. But again, you don't know the facts, so how can you get angry at the right people? God forbid you actually do your fucking homework when you talk on national TV to millions of people. And Geraldo dared there explain why it is that Iran might hate us, outside of the obvious, which is there are, you know, there's some religious hatred. There's, you know, I know many people in Iran, and they'll tell you, yeah, there's high levels of anti-Semitism here, for example. There's no doubt that some of the hatred is purely religious. I'm not denying that in any way, shape, or form. Or I should say it stems from religious differences. So, granted, I admit that. But Geraldo dared to talk about other factors which might play into the government of Iran or the people of Iran hating the U.S. Like, for example, when we shot down a civilian plane of theirs. Did you see how outraged all the other people on the panel were? Oh, my God, you brought up a fact! We don't like facts if they are seemingly say we did something bad. So, oh, we're so angry. Why would you bring that up? Because it's a fucking fact, you dipshit. What do you want to do? Just sit there and blow the U.S. government line the entire time when having this conversation? Oh, Iran, they're pure evil. They're pure bad. They've never done anything right. In every single way, shape, and form, they're the worst, and we're the best. We did everything so right. Geraldo dares to say, well, you know, there was that one time that we did. Like, shut up! Shut up! And, Geraldo, we can go further here. Let's face it, the 1953 coup. A lot of people don't know this, man. In 1953, the CIA overthrew the Iranian government. That's not Alex Jones' conspiracy. That's admitted to. That's admitted to. It's declassified documents. It was a huge story not that long ago because they just recently declassified it. Up until that point, we all had to speculate that that was the case, even though a lot of us knew that was the case either way. We overthrew Mohammad Mossadegh, who was the democratically elected leader, because Mossadegh was going to nationalize the oil industry, and that would have screwed over the West, the U.S. and Britain. So what do? We said we can't have it. He actually gives a shit about the people of Iran, overthrew him, put in the Shah, a dictator. Now, in some ways, the Shah was good on social issues. He was more secular, and we like that, and I think a lot of people like that. But the Iranian people did not want to have a fucking dictator, a puppet dictator, put in there by the U.S. That's obvious. That's obvious. So that's one of the reasons they hate us. Also, why do they hate us? Oh, I don't know. Maybe the fact that we backed Saddam and we armed Saddam when Saddam fucking invaded them? Maybe that has something to do with it. Nope, nope. You can't bring up any reason why Iran might be angry at the U.S. And let's be clear. When they say debt to America, is that okay? Am I like, yeah, rock and roll, say it all day? Of course not. Of course I'm against that. Who would be for that? That's crazy if anybody's, oh, yeah, it's fine when they say that. No, no. But by the same token, I condemn that completely. Hey, Eric Bowling, do you condemn it when we have politicians in this country that openly muse out loud about nuking Iran? I can't hear you. I can't hear you because you didn't do it and you won't do it, because when we do overtly violent, wrong rhetoric, you're fine with it. When they do it, you'll condemn it all day long. When we do it, shh. Duncan Hunter, not that long ago, probably about a year and a half ago, said we should just nuke them. Just drop a nuke there. Let them know we mean business. Sheldon Adelson, a top GOP donor, same thing. We should drop a nuke in the desert there to let them know we mean business. Louis Gohmert every other day muses out loud about we should just bomb their facilities, their nuclear facilities, which are used for power for their citizens. He says just bomb, bomb. John McCain saying bomb Iran. Was Eric Bowling all outraged? Oh, my God, overtly violent rhetoric. You can't defend this. No, only when it's Iran's overtly violent rhetoric is it a problem. Whereas to sane people like me, oh, that's a problem when Iran does it and when we do it. Because I'm against violence across the board. If it's unjust violence and it's not in self-defense, well, then of course I'm against it. And then, of course, I have to bring this up just real quick. But Geraldo, when he gets mad, he turns into a baby. It's hilarious. You said that to make me look stupid, and I don't like it. What the fuck, dude? First of all, he's making an ass of himself, so calm down. You're going to look better in this conversation no matter what. But why, when you get angry, you turn into a toddler? Like, you don't know how to reel that in a little bit, huh? I don't like it! Who says that? What a baby. So even the guy in the conversation who's most right looks like a child. Fox News in a nutshell. Now we go to Ben Carson. And his theocracy probs. I got a bunch of clips for this one. I hate the multiple clip segments, but you got to do them sometimes. Ben Carson recently caused some controversy when he said that a Muslim shouldn't be president and Muslim presidents are inconsistent with the U.S. Constitution. Now, of course, that's not true, but saying something that's not true never stopped Ben Carson before. So he went on Hannity to explain further, and unsurprisingly, he shoved his foot in his mouth again.
Do you stand by the comments?
Absolutely, I stand by the comments. You know, what we have to do is we have to recognize that this is America, and we have a constitution, and we do not put people and at the leadership of our country whose faith might interfere with them carrying out the duties of the Constitution. So if, for instance, you believe in a theocracy, I don't care if you're a Christian. If you're a Christian and you're running for president and you want to make this into a theocracy, I'm not going to support you. I'm not going to advocate you being the president.
So his point is, well, when I said that Muslims shouldn't be president in America, I just mean that I'm against anybody who would advocate for a theocracy. So that means, in his mind, Muslims, by definition, a Muslim cannot be president. He said it before. Look at what he said before. He said, no, a Muslim cannot be president. So he thinks Muslims, by definition, are in favor of a theocracy. But he's kind, and he says, even if it's a Christian who's in favor of theocracy, I'd be against that. Now, should everybody be against theocracy? Of course. That's one of the main things we advocate for on this show, day in and day out. But why is he still wrong? Because to think every single Muslim on the planet is in favor of a theocracy is just not true. In fact, American Muslims are some of the most secular Muslims in the world. Just to give one example here, Keith Ellison, who's a Democratic congressman, is a Muslim. He's way more secular than anybody on the Republican side, whether running for president or not. So this idea that, and you go back and you look at his original comments, he said, no, Muslims shouldn't be president. Well, to think, the fact that you think you can say that and, you know, just shield any criticism against you and then clarify by saying, I'm just against theocracy, is utter nonsense, but it gets better. Really, Ben Carson, that's the claim you're going to make? I'm not against Muslims per se. I'm just against theocracy. Really? Well, have you ever heard this Republican politician talk before? What's his name again? Oh, here it says Ben Carson.
The detractors say that that's a slippery slope because now, next thing you're going to have Catholics who refuse to issue a marriage license to people who have been divorced, or Muslims who refuse to issue a marriage license to people who want to, you know, Muslims who want to marry Christians, and so on. Where does it end?
But this is a very basic right. You know, this is a Judeo-Christian nation in the sense that a lot of our values and principles are based on our Judeo-Christian faith.
Flat tax. How would that work?
Well, I like the idea of a proportional tax. That way you pay according to your ability. And I got that idea, quite frankly, from the Bible, tithing.
Their hypocrisy is so overwhelming that sometimes I feel like they've been trolling us all along. Like, everything about Ben Carson from day one, everything about all these Republican presidential candidates from day one, they're just trolling us. Dude, you really had the nerve to go out there and say, I'm against theocracy. When we have a record of you making outwardly, overtly, blatantly theocratic arguments. You said you base your tax plan on the Bible. You said we are a Judeo-Christian nation, and that's where we get our principles from. We don't. We don't. To be clear, we're a secular nation, the first official secular nation. But these are the points you made. And also, how's this for a kicker? He doesn't believe in evolution. He's a neurosurgeon. He doesn't believe in evolution. So we have a Christian fundamentalist theocrat who's lecturing all Muslims, including secular Muslims, that, well, you Muslims can never be president because you believe in theocracy. No, you believe in theocracy, and this is our main problem with the Christian right. Utter hypocrisy. They're totally blind to their own extremism because, as I told you guys before, it's tribalism 101. They think, I'm a Christian, Christians are good by definition, and the Muslims are bad by definition, which is why, by the way, whenever any Muslim ever does a terrorist attack, they think it's representative of Muslims, generally speaking. And anytime any Christian does violence, what do they say right away? That guy's not a Christian. He's just not a Christian. He might say he's a Christian. It might be overtly written down in his diary or whatever the case is. He might say, I did this attack in the name of my Christianity, like the Phineas movement shooting, which recently happened in Texas. And these guys will say, nope, not a Christian. In fact, Bill O'Reilly literally said that when Anders Breivik, when we learned his motivations, and a lot of that has to do with he's a right-winger, but also he's a Christian, and he was afraid of the Islamization and creeping socialism coming in Scandinavia. Bill O'Reilly did a talk once where he said, no, but he's not Christian, though. Anders Breivik goes, I'm a Christian. He goes, no, you're not a Christian. What the fuck? Again, what is this showing here? Christians, by definition, are good and right and just. Muslims, by definition, are bad and wrong and should never be president and are terrible. And it's this gross black-and-white kind of thinking, where he really believes, no, I am against theocracy. But then he advocates for theocracy. Because what does he really mean? I'm against theocracy when the other does it, when they do it. Because they're not me, they're not part of my religion, they're foreign, and I'm a tribalist, so fuck them no matter what. Even if they're secular, I'm just going to pretend they're in favor of theocracy. Me, I'll pretend like I'm secular, but I'm really in favor of a theocracy, and look the other way because my theocracy is good theocracy, and don't you dare call me out on my hypocrisy. Well, I am going to do it, and I wish the rest of the media would do it, because your hypocrisy is so clear, that even the biggest Ben Carson defender would have to go, ooh, why the fuck did you say that? All right, I'm going to skip this one and go to Dr. Carl Hart, because I need to. I don't want to run out of time before I get to him. Dr. Carl Hart is an associate professor of psychology and psychiatry at Columbia, and he's done research into drug abuse and drug addiction, and he went on Joe Rogan's podcast where he proceeded to drop a truth bomb on us. Take a look.
Drugs is just such a weighted and loaded term. The fact that that term could be used for a steroid as well as for aspirin or coffee, it's really kind of unfortunate that we have this one blanket term that applies to psychedelics, and as well it applies to testosterone and it applies to heroin. I mean, there's too many things.
I actually like that.
Do you?
Yeah. Why don't you like it? I mean, because when we think about one of the things that bothers me about the psychedelic kind of movement, and God bless them, people who enjoy this thing, but, you know, people separate their drug use, like the psychedelic use, mm-hmm. like I'm using this to go on a higher plane or for some other mm-hmm. reason, as opposed to the person on the corner who's getting high. It's like, you can rationalize your drug use however you want, but you're using drugs, and it's all the same thing. You know, so it's like, it's a beautiful thing. It's like we're all together in this.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not better than you with my drug use, and you're not better than me with your drug use.
Oh, I see.
I love that.
It's the elitism of the psychedelic
exactly.
community that annoys you.
Exactly. Or other people. I mean, this notion, like even the marijuana smokers, when they talk about marijuana and not talk about crack and not talk about heroin, what the fuck is that? Mm. I mean, come on. You're doing a drug just like I'm doing this drug. And so it's hypocrisy.
I was in Geneva. I just got back in the States, and I was working in a heroin clinic where they administer heroin every day, 7 days a week, twice a day, to people who meet criteria for heroin addiction.
And when I say they administer heroin, I don't mean like small doses. I mean doses that go up to like a gram a day, 1,000 milligrams a day, a lot more than what people use here in the States typically. And these people who are getting heroin every day, a large percentage of them also go to work. A large percentage of them have families, and they're taking care of their responsibilities. This is their treatment, and this is a treatment that works for them. But their treatment includes 2 daily doses of intravenous heroin, 7 days a week. You know, and so, like, when I think about, well, one of the reasons I went there and I did this because of the way we think of heroin in this country. We think of it as such as evil drug. And that's just American mythology. And that's just wrong. That's ignorance. But that's how many, including drug experts in this country, think of heroin. But that's just, we have all of this great technology, but we're so ignorant when it comes to many of these drugs.
So heroin administered intravenously on a daily basis is not, it's not devastating?
No. In fact, some people would do better by having a daily dose of heroin or another opiate. No, it's not devastating.
Don't lie. Even the progressives out there and the people who think they're open-minded on this are like, whoa, mind blown. Now, I've told this story on air before, but I think it bears mentioning again. One of my best friends' dad is a world-renowned lung doctor and an ICU doctor. And so he goes all over the place and he gives speeches in all these different countries. And, you know, the people who come to listen to his speeches are young doctors who are successful and who have a career and are dedicated and all this stuff. And apparently, I don't know exactly where the person was visiting, whether it was Switzerland or whether it was France or wherever. But after one of the speeches he gave, remember, world-renowned doctor here, a group of students, young doctors, came up to him and said, hey, we're going to go do some heroin. You want to join us? He was like, what the fuck? Because he also has a more Americanized view of drugs. Understandably so. He's American. And the idea that they're getting at here is the reefer madness mentality. Remember the old reefer madness movie? Oh, my God, marijuana is going to make you get raped behind a dumpster. Just ridiculous propaganda. You'll go crazy. Woo-hoo! We don't just have reefer madness for reefer, for marijuana in this country. We have drug propaganda that's embedded in your mind for drugs across the board. The fact that you watching this probably thought, well, if you do cocaine, your life is ruined. If you do heroin, your life is ruined. But you could do marijuana, that's fine. The fact that you categorize, well, that one's worse, that one's better, this one's a problem, shows that you fell for the propaganda. Everybody at some point or another fell for the propaganda. And what Carl Hart is saying here is, look, I'm the one that did the fucking research. I'm the expert here. I've been all around. I see how different places do it. The idea that if you do cocaine or do heroin, you're done. Your life's over. You're going to be sucking dicks behind an Arby's soon. Not true. He's telling you right here, there are places around the world in modern nations where they have treatment centers where you go and you get a dose of heroin. And then you go about your business. You go work. You know, you come home. Now, I know a lot of people listen to this like, that's crazy. I would never even consider that. That option seems off the table. But just understand that you're the one that's being dogmatic. You're the one that's not open to evidence. You're the one that doesn't care about empiricism. You're the one that doesn't care about what actually works. He's the expert. He's telling you, I've seen this. It works. So this isn't a matter of opinion. This is a matter of, oh, I see that this person gets heroin 2 times a day, 7 days a week, and they take care of their kids, and they pay their bills, and they do all these things. You didn't think that was possible. Don't lie. It is possible. In fact, at a TED Talk Dr. Carl Hart gave, he said that 80 to 90%, listen closely here, of all drug users are moderate users. Do I need to repeat that? 80 to 90% of all drug users are moderate users. And everybody needs to check their fucking biases here, man. Because I see this all the time. Progressives also have their biases. They might say, oh, I don't have my bias. Nonsense. Go look at any progressive show, including the network I'm on, the Young Turks, the main channel. You go look through their video archive history. You tell me how many positive stories they did about weed, almost 100%, and how many negative stories they did about opiate pills. Almost 100% of the stories are negative. The idea doesn't enter their mind. Well, maybe there's such thing as a moderate user who can recreationally use it and take care of their business. Yeah, that does exist. 80 to 90% of them, that exists. Dr. Carl Hart goes on to explain that as well. And I have personal experience because I'm one of the guys who the drugs I actually like are the drugs that nobody else admits to liking. I love fucking Adderall pills recreationally. Unfortunately, I can't get them on a regular basis. But I would love popping one of those things and having a good time. I like opiate pills. Again, I can't get them on a regular basis, but I've taken them recreationally for years. And I never had a fucking problem. But this idea that society tells you, no, by definition, you have a problem because you keep taking it. Well, who the fuck are you? I'm still taking care of my business, and it gives me a little pep. It makes my mood a little better, so piss off. Who are you to say that? It all comes from moralistic dogmatism where the idea is, no, just simply by the fact that you take it, you are wrong and bad. In other words, I don't care about what actually happens after you take it, if you're productive, if you're happy, yada, yada. No, just the fact that you took it, you are bad. Well, that is dogmatism, that is moralism, and that's very close to fundamentalist religion in how you think. And finally, let me just say this. Crocodile and crystal meth, for example. So these are two drugs that really are dangerous. And a lot of people are thinking there as I'm doing this rant, like, come on, Kyle, there aren't some drugs that are fucked up and there's no hope you can use them moderately. Those drugs do exist, but why do those drugs exist? Those drugs exist because drugs are illegal. The problem with Crocodile is that it is a cheap heroin knockoff where they cut it with all different types of chemicals that literally make your skin rot off. If you legalize, tax, and regulate drugs, you don't need to cut it with the nonsense that makes your fucking skin peel off. Crystal meth, same thing. It's got all types of nonsense in it. Diesel fuel, nail polish remover, terrible stuff. That's what's bad for you in crystal meth. So in other words, if you had legalized Adderall pills, amphetamine pills, whatever, in safe doses, people would get that instead of going to a back alley and injecting fucking diesel fuel or smoking diesel fuel and nail polish remover chemical crystal meth. So the problem is because it's illegal. That's the problem. Almost all the problems go away once you legalize, tax, and regulate. So let's understand this. Now, I'm doing a lot of talking here, and I'm not an expert in this, admittedly, but you just heard it from the expert. You heard it from Dr. Carl Hart, and he's one of the only people telling the truth about drugs. All right, let me go to Kim Davis. I'm only going to have time for one more story here. Unfortunately, well, actually, I can't even do Kim Davis. Let me go to global warming because this is very important. There's a new report out in the journal Nature on climate change, and it's devastating. So they say the following, quote, the gross domestic product of the United States was nearly $17.5 trillion in 2014. That's enough money to buy all the planet's gold two times over. But if the world's permafrost thaws, as a new study warns, humanity could be saddled with a bill that adds up to more than $43 trillion to the already massive climate-related debt the world will rack up in the next two centuries. So Kevin Schaefer, a research scientist at the National Snow and Ice Data Center, called this, quote, an economic death sentence beyond comprehension. Goddamn. $43 trillion it'll cost us. So they explain how permafrost is basically permanently frozen ground in the world's coldest places. And if it thaws, that means the 10,000 years worth of organic matter will be released into the atmosphere. And it basically is, you know, posing all this organic matter, which was stored in there for thousands of years. So, and the way they explain it in the piece is, imagine broccoli. So the power goes out, your broccoli's in the freezer, it thaws, and then what happens after it thaws? It's going to decompose. It's going to smell disgusting in there, and it's going to be releasing greenhouse gases, they say. So it's a way to at least double the amount of greenhouse gases we currently have, and once we hit that tipping point, which is another tipping point, we're Foxville. And they say, get this, the cost of the disaster is $43 trillion, perhaps by the year 2200, which is really not that much in the grand scheme of things. So I've told you guys this before, but I'll say it again. I fear we've already gone too far. I mean, we should already be at the point where we use nothing but renewable energies and we're sustainable. But for, you know, corruption reasons, lobbyist reasons, big oil reasons, you name it, we're not at that point yet. And we've already hit previous tipping points before with the parts per million carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So I don't know what the fuck it's going to take, man. We already have an increase in extreme weather. We already have a trillion and one problems. Still, we drag our feet. We're only moving slightly in the right direction, if that. We got to get serious. And if this doesn't sway even the fiscal conservatives and the economic conservatives, I don't know what will. Do you want to save $43 trillion, end humanity, or not? It's that simple. All right, guys, I'm out of time. Mwah. We'll see you tomorrow. Peace.